This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden arrived in the United Kingdom Wednesday ahead of Friday's start of the G7 summit. Biden kicked off his U.K. visit, telling U.S. troops stationed at the Royal Air Force Mildenhall in Suffolk, the country is proud of their service and sacrifices also made by their families. Biden also told the troops is going to communicate to Russian President Vladimir Putin next week that there are consequences for violating the sovereignty of democracies in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. Russian-based hackers are believed to be behind ransomware attacks on a major U.S. fuel supplier and one of the country's largest suppliers of meats. The president's main agenda in the U.K. is to attend the G7 summit, a meeting of the world's seven most advanced democracies, the United States, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, and Italy, and Japan. News reports say the United States is set to buy a half billion more doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to share globally. According to people familiar with the plan, President Biden Thursday will announce the administration's going to buy 500 million doses for sharing through the global COVAX alliance. Sources say 200 million doses would be shared this year and the rest in the first half of next year. Sources, the announcement comes after the White House unveiled plans to start sharing America's existing vaccine supply, or surplus that is, with other nations. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland warning Wednesday that ransom-motivated cyber attacks are getting worse and worse, his words, echoing other top Biden administration officials who have sounded the alarm about the problem in recent weeks. The Attorney General's warning during a Senate hearing on the Justice Department's fiscal 2022 budget requests followed a pair of high-profile ransomware attacks over the past month that have rattled the U.S. national security and law enforcement establishment and sparked calls for beefed-up cyber defenses. In a ransomware attack, hackers lock a company's or organization's data, offering keys to unlock the files in exchange for a large sum of money. The Justice Department nearly $36 billion budget includes about $1.1 billion for cybersecurity. Approved by Congress, that would constitute the largest increase in cybersecurity resources for the department in more than a decade, according to the Attorney General. A Russian court has been considering a request from prosecutors to ban organizations founded by jail opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed into law a bill that barred members of organizations that have been declared extremist groups from running for public office after the measure was quickly approved by lawmakers. If the court outlaws Navalny's organization, it could spell an end to the massive political network he established to challenge Putin's grip on power. Navalny, Putin's fiercest critic, is serving 2.5-year prison sentence for parole violations stemming from a 2014 embezzlement conviction he maintained was politically motivated. Supporters of presidential candidates Pedro Castillo and Keiko Fujimori took to the streets of Lima Wednesday demanding that electoral authorities release the final results of the presidential runoff after more than 17 million Peruvians cashed their ballots on Sunday to decide a new president. Castillo's supporters marched in Peru's capital a day after the socialist candidate proclaimed himself the winner of the elections, although the count has not yet been completed. Fujimori's supporters gathered outside the electoral council to denounce the irregularities and indications of fraud during Sunday's election. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. UN Human Rights Council submits new evidence of Somali troops' presence in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
We have raised our concerns and demanded the president to come out clean on the allegation that Somali soldiers training in Eritrea were deployed in Ethiopia and Tigray.
An ECOWAS delegation ends yet another visit to Mali. Slow vaccination rate in Africa could have major consequences. Botswana's president prioritizes vaccinating teachers, and women take high positions in Ugandan President Museveni's new cabinet.
I know that this cabinet falls short by 8%, but it's a big improvement compared to the previous cabinet, and we welcome that progress.
And this morning, a conversation with Liberian First Lady Claire Marie Dekonti Weah. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Pressure is growing on Somalia's government after a report this week that thousands of Somali troops sent for training in Eritrea ended up fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray conflict. Parents of missing troops have blamed President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, also known as Farmajo, who denies the reports. But as Mohamed Kahia reports from Mogadishu, a parliamentary committee is demanding an investigation into the troops' whereabouts.
A report by UN Human Rights Council released this week says troops from Somalia who were trained in Eritrea have taken part in the fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Somalia's government has consistently denied that its troops were present in Tigray. Forced Wardera is among hundreds of parents seeking answers from the Somali government. Her son, 22-year-old Sid Ali Abdi, was among the troops sent to Eritrea for training. She says her son left for Eritrea in February last year, and she didn't hear from him until January this year. She added that he called again last week, but she is afraid for his life and therefore is calling upon authorities to ensure his safe return home. Somalia's President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo has not commented on the soldiers, despite demands from their parents and the opposition leaders. Parliament's Foreign Affairs and International Relations Committee has sent two letters to the Office of the President for clarification on the matter, but has gotten no response. Mohamed Hassan Idris, who is a member of the powerful committee, said the President must take responsibility for the national security matter.
We have raised our concerns and demanded the President to come out clean on the allegation that Somali soldiers training in Eritrea were deployed in Ethiopia and Tigray. Despite our two official letters and verbal demands, including the daily protests by the parents of the soldiers, unfortunately, the president has never come out to respond the disappearance of these children. But instead, he kept silence, and it is very, very disturbing situation.
In June 2018, the leaders of Somalia, Ethiopia, and Eritrea signed a security, political, and economic cooperation agreement. Absalam Guleid is a security analyst and former deputy director of Somalia's National Security and Intelligence Agency, NISA, who was closely monitoring the situation. He says it's not clear how many soldiers have been killed in Tigray.
We don't know the exact number of who died in the process of training or fighting alongside the Eritrean and Tigray region of Ethiopia. It is kind of a black hole. And unless we find out the original files, it will be very difficult to verify how many were sent and how many were still living. So it is very important to find out the roots of original numbers of these missing soldiers.
The UN Human Rights Council has elected a representative from Somalia in Geneva to serve as one of the four vice presidents on its bureau. Ambassador Abiyan Mohamed Saleh will serve in the significant UN body until December of this year as her country faces charges of violations in neighboring Ethiopia. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Rights activists in Uganda have welcomed the appointment of women in President Yoweri Museveni's new cabinet, announced Tuesday this week. However, they decry what they are calling a bloated government, saying it will highly impact taxpayers. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakaringi has more from Kampala.
President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni announced the new cabinet Tuesday evening on his Twitter social media, 1 month after he was sworn in for his sixth term of office. I hereby inform the country that by the virtue of the authority given to the President of Uganda, I hereby appoint Her Excellency the Vice President, Right Honorable Prime Minister, Honorable Cabinet Ministers and other ministers, as indicated here, President Museveni tweeted. For the first time in the history of Uganda, the President appointed a woman as Prime Minister, Robin Nabanja, a member of the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. The President also appointed a retired army officer, Major Jessica Alupo, as his vice president, and several other women, including the First Lady, Janet Museveni, who retained her post as the Minister of Education. Mr. Museveni also appointed former Speaker of Parliament, Rebecca Kadaga, as First Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for East African Community Affairs. Activist Sarah Biriete, the Executive Director at the Center for Constitutional Governance, says she's glad women have been appointed in top positions. She says the increment has been long overdue.
The Constitution and Article 32, together with Articles 3 and 4 of the AU Constitutive Act, provide that there must be gender parity, and that is 50-50 men-women representation in positions of leadership. I know that this cabinet falls short by 8%, but it's a big improvement compared to the previous cabinet, and we welcome that progress.
At least 27 women out of 80 officials will serve in the new cabinet. Researcher and political analyst Deus Mobiru says the appointments are a move in the right direction. He says the appointment of women in such positions will inspire other women, young and old, to do well in socio-political spheres of life.
It's a positive move, because even appointing women in its own sake increases on their visibility, and it therefore something that impacts on other women and gives them a platform and a chance for them to deliver, not only for women but also for the whole country.
Both Virete and Mubiru say they are concerned the bloated size of the cabinet will highly affect the taxpayer. Lawyer and activist Sise Kagaba agrees.
In as far as service delivery is concerned, that is what each and every Ugandan is going to be concerned about, not who is in which position. Because at times we've seen people hold positions and we think that they are going to do much, and really nothing much happens. Because in most cases we know that there's one alpha and omega when it comes to the way government is run. We are seeing some new faces. It's just like getting new wine, but you're putting it in old bottles.
Some of the notable absentees in the new cabinet are former Foreign Affairs Minister Sam Kutesa, Vice President Edward Sekandi, and the outgoing Prime Minister Ruakana Rugunda. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
A former special representative of the UN Secretary General and head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel says there is a concern that perhaps West Africa may be witnessing a slippage or retreat of democracy, which the region has been able to painfully construct over the years. Mohamed Ibn Chambers says the region's political class and civil society expect that the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, will have the same standards when it comes to judging constitutional changes of government, whether by the military or by sitting presidents. This comes as the high-power ECOWAS delegation has ended yet another visit to Mali, where the military there has staged two coup d'etats this year alone. Chambers says in spite of ECOWAS's reaffirmation of intolerance for coup d'etats, the subregion is willing to work closely with the transitional authorities to ensure a successful transition in Mali.
They have had what the delegation has considered very fruitful discussions with the president and also the prime minister. And I think they have been able to use that occasion to underscore the fact that in spite of Mali being suspended from the institutions of ECOWAS, in conformity with ECOWAS protocols. The ECOWAS will do all it can to support Mali to ensure a successful transition from now till the end of that transition. And this is very important that on the one hand, ECOWAS has reaffirmed its policy of zero tolerance for coup d'etat. At the same time, it is keenly aware of the complexity of the situation in Mali and will work closely with the transitional authorities to ensure a successful transition in Mali. And in that regard, the immediacy requires for a government to be now put in place following wide consultations to ensure that this transitional government reflects a broad spectrum of Malian political and civil society.
Mr. Chambers, there were some skepticism following the last ECOWAS meeting. Some analysts were saying they don't think that the transition process in Mali is going to stay on track. Does ECOWAS think that this transition is on schedule?
9 months is still a lot of time. It is true that some time has been lost because of the political situation, which has caused some important activities which were required to be undertaken to be delayed. But I think now all hands should be on deck and the focus should be on drawing up a clear calendar for the rest of the transition. I think ECOWAS will be seeking to work closely with other partners such as the United Nations, the European Union, and bilateral partners who can support the transitional effort. So I think that it was quite encouraging that the special representative of Secretary General of UN in Mali was also consulting very closely with the ECOWAS mediator and his team and seeing how they can all put their efforts together.
People have been talking about there are two types of unconstitutional changes of government. One, the use of the military. Then the other one where presidents extend beyond their constitutional terms to stay in power. People say that ECOWAS has not been very fair in dealing with those presidents who extend their term in office, but they come down hard on a country like Mali where the military comes in.
I think this debate is very lively and on now in West Africa in particular. There is concern that maybe West Africa may be witnessing a slippage, a retreat in the democracy which it has been able to painfully construct. So I think that the West African civil society and the political class will be taking this quite seriously. And we will expect that ECOWAS will have the same standard for judging unconstitutional changes in government, whether they are from the military or from sitting governments.
Mr. Chambers, it's always a pleasure to speak with you with your knowledge of the sub-region. Thank you so much.
Thank you, James. Always a pleasure.
Mohammed Ibn Chambers is the former special representative of the UN Secretary General and head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. You are speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 10. By any measure, the number of those being vaccinated against COVID-19 in Africa is running behind the rest of the world. Health experts warn that the failure to inoculate the 1.3 billion people on the continent will have a huge impact on its healthcare systems and economies. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
More than a year into the COVID-19 pandemic, most African countries have vaccinated only a tiny fraction of their citizens. Nigeria, the most populous nation in Africa, has fully vaccinated just 0.1% of the population. The Africa Center for Disease Control says three countries, Tanzania, Burundi, Eritrea, and the self-declared Sahrawi Republic, have yet to receive any vaccines, while Burkina Faso has received 115,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, but has yet to give a single jab to its citizens. Abdallah Ziraba is an epidemiologist and the head of the health system at the African Population and Health Research Center in Nairobi. He says the failure to vaccinate is partly due to vaccine hesitancy among the population and underdeveloped healthcare systems, especially in non-urban areas.
The other important reason why there has been inequity is the weak healthcare system. In Africa, most people live in rural areas, and the healthcare system, which should be the system to deliver the vaccines to the last person, is not as elaborate as the population is distributed. So some people are very far away from where they can get access to vaccines, and as a consequence, they are definitely left out, but they remain at risk of getting exposed to COVID-19.
Kenya has fully vaccinated just 13,000 people out of a population of 50 million, although about 1 million have received one dose of a vaccine. Devji Atela is the Secretary General of the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union. He calls for the government to allocate 1% of the country's budget to purchase COVID-19 vaccines.
Countries like, let's say, Uganda or here in Kenya and these others, we can still see the waves, the surge in the infection. So the ultimate way to have things back to normal is to vaccinate. And that's why we are asking the government that in the budget, current budget is about 3.6 trillion. If 1% of it, that's about 35 billion, is put into buying of the vaccine for the Kenyans, then we may have hope to see the opening up.
Kenya's western region is witnessing high coronavirus infections in recent weeks, and officials have warned they may have to impose a new lockdown to stop transmission. In neighboring Uganda, the government recently reintroduced a strict lockdown to fight an increase in infections. The lockdown includes shutting down the schools and religious activities and imposing travel bans within the country. Zeraba says African countries' failure to vaccinate their population will disrupt everyday life and will be a problem to the rest of the world.
It will be a cascade that will be very disruptive of the African countries' economies and healthcare system. But the rest of the world will not sit pretty, because while a big part of their population will be protected, they will not be comfortable knowing that there will be new infections coming to their borders every now and then.
Overall, Africa has recorded about 5 million cases of COVID-19 and 133,000 deaths. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Botswana President Mokwesi Masisi says his government will prioritize vaccinating teachers after 50 of them died from COVID-19. Teachers had urged that schools be closed as the virus continues to claim the lives of their colleagues. Nkundise Dube reports.
Botswana President, in a televised message to commemorate World Teachers' Day yesterday, said his government was concerned about the welfare of teachers. Education sector unions had criticized Masisi's government for its slow response after at least 30 educators died from COVID-19 since March. Botswana began a third round of its vaccination program on Monday, and Masisi says teachers and other frontline workers will be at the front of the queue to receive the jab.
We will not hesitate to provide you with the necessary support for you to perform your duty under a safe environment. My government will roll out a successful and timely vaccination program to curb the impact of the disease on our people, including yourselves. Teachers, I am pleased to confirm that teachers and other frontliners will be vaccinated as a priority.
But Botswana Teachers Union President Hudlamang Utsile says the government has not done enough to protect teachers during COVID-19.
Every time a teacher goes to work, his or her life is at risk. Teachers can easily contract COVID-19 from the innocent souls whose development they are committed to. It is sad and demoralizing that despite growth evidence, the government is yet to recognize COVID-19 as the grave workplace hazard it is.
Botswana has vaccinated 149,268 of its citizens, representing 7% of the population. However, most still await the second jab. The country announced last week it has reached an agreement with vaccine supplier Moderna for an undisclosed quantity of doses. The world's leading diamond miner De Beers has pledged about $50 million to buy vaccines. Masisi says the Southern African country has procured enough to inoculate the entire adult population. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haboroni, Botswana.
Liberia's First Lady, Clara Marie Dekanti Weah, says she will continue to do what her heart tells her to do and not what people are criticizing her about. She says she is focused on uplifting the disadvantaged young women of Liberia, empower them, and make their lives better. Yesterday, Wednesday, Mrs. Weah unveiled the She's You Menstrual and Personal Hygiene Initiative to help educate young underprivileged women properly manage their menstruation, thereby minimizing discrimination and stigma. Mrs. Weah explains.
Yes, well, in becoming a first lady and living consistently in Liberia, I realized that a lot of our young girls are not aware of certain health hygiene. They're not really well educated about their menstrual cycle. And when you try to bring it up to them, they shy away from it. So I was once 13, 12, 14, a teenager, and I didn't have someone to talk to me about those issues. So we decided to start this great initiative and going around Liberia and talking to young girls from poor community, disadvantaged girls in Liberia, and try to educate them about their body and about being hygienic in many different sense, especially where their period is concerned, their menstruation. And I just took on that initiative and we ran with it, and we discovered that so many of them don't have a parent in the house, don't know much about themselves. And I just feel this initiative will educate them and even educate their parents as well. So that's the purpose of me really doing that, taking this initiative on.
If I hear you clearly, Madam First Lady, you're on a mission to educate young women and maybe perhaps their parents. In addition to that, do you provide other kind of assistance to help these young women overcome this stigma?
Before today, we've done some pre-launching of what we spoke about today. And what we've done is we bought a large amount of health products that we distribute to girls in the villages such as Bassa County, Magibi, Bomi. We've gone all around Liberia, and we intend to continue to do that. And we distribute not only pads, we distribute toothpaste, we distribute soap, toothbrushes, deodorant, many, many different things that young girls need to keep themselves clean. So, I mean, what else is there to do? We're trying our best so that during their menstruation, they're not stigmatized, they're not teased about it. So we're trying to do as much as we can, yes.
Without downplaying, because I think this is an important project that you have undertaken, but Madam First Lady, some people will argue that there are other issues that Liberian women are faced with each day, such as domestic abuse, rape, lack of education for girls, etc.
I said people are going to complain no matter what you do. I have to do what my heart tells me to do. I wear the hat for many different people in our society, and I can't change everything in our society, but the ones that have children are a very important factor for me in our society and women. And I try my best to touch every single topic I've done my best with in terms of rape. We've done many things in terms of education and building a school for to educate underprivileged girls in Liberia at the moment. I build a home for the elderly. So you know what? I'm going to do basically what my heart pushes me to do and not focus on what people are criticizing me about. That's what I want to do. I want to uplift the young girls in our society, the disadvantaged young women in our society. And whatever I have to do to empower them and to make their lives better, I will do it regardless of the criticism. I am a humanitarian. I'm not involved with the government work. I can assist them in doing certain things and be an advocate to the government to help them. But I am not too concerned about the criticism out there, sir.
Mrs. Clara Weah and First Lady of Liberia, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and keep up the work that you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That was Liberian First Lady Clara Marie Dekanti Weah. She was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. And that's it for this Thursday, June 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, Israel's new power-sharing government. Can a leader of Jewish settlers, a secular TV anchor, and the head of an Islamist party, united in their aversion to Benjamin Netanyahu, not much else, govern Israel? We'll ask our two experts about the challenges facing Israel as it ousts longtime Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and enters uncharted waters. That's Encounter on The Voice of America.